Welcome to Power CEOs, the truth behind the business. I'm Jen Godin, your fearless host, entrepreneur, investor, business strategist. Why are we here? Because I believe that iron strengthens iron. And when we share what's working in business and maybe even some of what's not, we're all able to learn and grow. As a result, our businesses grow. And the ripple effect impacts not only ourselves, our teams, and their families, but also our businesses and our world. You are in for a treat because we are talking all things future of business today. Specifically, how is AI reshaping the financial industry from the inside out? We've got Taylor Matthews here. He is the co-founder and CEO of Farther, a modern wealth platform that's rethinking how advisors operate, scale, and serve clients. Taylor, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me. Really great to be here.
I'm really excited about this. So folks, if your financial business still runs on spreadsheets and headcounts, you're not scaling, you're stalling. AI isn't coming to financial services. It's already rewriting it. Taylor, talk to me about what's broken in traditional financial services and why did AI unlock the solution?
Well, I think a big thing that's broken is the financial system is pretty old. We're still mostly operating on systems, core banking systems, trading systems, and things like that, that were originally built in the 80s, sometimes even older. These aren't AI native. They're often not even cloud native or internet native, but they, you know, fax machines are still used. There are still DocuSigns are printed out offshore and rekeyed in by hand. This is the world that we live in still. I think that creates an opportunity to build it back better and make the entire efficient a little bit more efficient, capable, and provide better outcomes to the clients and advisors we serve. So we're on the wealth management side of the equation.
And so you're talking about inefficiencies that are there. You're talking about core systems that are really behind the times, considering we're in 2026 nowadays. What was the one straw that broke the camel's back for you? Because I know you were so innovation forward. What was that one thing that had you say, you know what, it's time, I'm going to innovate?
Well, in my prior role, like immediately before founding Farther, I was in a position that gave me this really fantastic vantage point, not only across lots of different individuals and how they manage their wealth, in particular their 401k wealth, but I also got to interact with a lot of financial advisors that almost all of them, regardless of where they were coming from big banks to, you know, folks who had hung their shingle down the way, they all were frustrated about the amount of time that they were spending on low value transactional work. Things like ops and admin and managing a team, a tech stack, all of the items that you have to do as an entrepreneur, as a business owner, but that are not necessarily adding a lot of value to your end clients. And because I had heard this, you know, so frequently from so many different people and looked around at the software that they were all using, it seemed like there was an opportunity to do something a little bit different. And so I began talking to everybody I knew about it and found my way to my co-founder who saw the same thing, both as a practitioner, as a wealth manager, and as an engineer. And we thought that maybe there was something that we could do that was a little bit different. And that was the start of Farther from our side.
That's fantastic. And, you know, I've been in AI for several years myself, and that's what we look for. We look for what are the biggest pain points that have a potential solution and go after it. So you saw that. And talk to me about, like, fast forward to today. Because you've got multiple things that you've done with Farther. There's a lot of solutions that you have brought to the industry. What or where does AI create the biggest operational leverage inside financial firms in your product suite, if you will? Like, what is it that's giving the biggest bang for your buck or the best ROI for those in the industry?
Well, I think there's a lot of answers to this, both internally and, like, you know, and more broadly. Perhaps we're still in a little bit of a discovery phase, but, you know, where we see the tools that we build for advisors being most utilized, we see advisors using insights more quickly to automate to automate a number of the tasks that they've historically done that, you know, by hand, and maybe were lower value add. So some of the, you know, back office tasks. And altogether, that makes an entire business run a little bit more smoothly. So I think it's some combination of what of where we're replacing low value work on the in the front office, in the middle office, and in the back office that doesn't that nobody ever sees, but that still can be quite costly if you let the let operational burden add up.
You're absolutely right about that. And so I'm going to ask a question, and I ask this of everyone in the AI space. It's the question that I ask every client who wants to do an AI integration in their industry. What part of the work should never be automated?
Well, I think in my space, it's pretty straightforward. It's trust. You can't automate the trust out of the business. And I think that that's one of the things that sets our industry apart, is that a lot of the value that you know, financial services firm brings to their clients is the trusted relationship that exists between a human, like a professional, and a client. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't automate many of the things that professional does. So the more that we can empower and make them more efficient in gaining knowledge about the client so that they can build that trust faster, delivering for the client, so generating more insights that they otherwise would not have been able to generate, being proactive instead of reactive, those are the things that that make the experience better, and they're fantastic to automate. But it's the fundamental human element, the emotional element that exists between an advisor and a client, I think, is one that you should never try to automate away.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I look at that as the relational aspect of it. And if we're going to be real, this applies to every industry, because people buy from people they know, like, and trust. People want to do business with people. And so that client relationship, that business to business relationship, those relationships have to be owned by the human beings, because that's an innately human aspect. And I couldn't agree with you more on the trust factor, because if we don't have trust, then what are we doing? I mean, we lose our entire portfolio.
That's exactly right. And we see many instances of companies who have tried to replace that trust element in our space in particular. I think robo-advisors as a category is an excellent example, where, you know, they provide a great product for a specific type of person, but there was a worry or a fear in the industry that they were going to gain a whole lot of market share and replace advisors, and that has just not come to pass. I think once you get to a certain level of you know, of assets, once you really can utilize a full service professional in their maximum capacity, like, you want to switch to that, and you want to rely on that in the future.
So let me ask you the next question. I ask this of everybody who is tech forward, whether they're AI enabled or AI native. What do you believe the next 5 years looks like for those financial professionals who are resisting AI and refuse, quite frankly, to leverage the technology in any fashion?
You know, our industry is a funny one, because I think the honest answer is there's for many advisors who refuse to participate, their businesses probably look a lot similar to what they do today. It's my belief that AI will become embedded in just about, you know, everything that an advisor will want to do. But the wealth industry is very sticky. Clients choose an advisor because they trust the advisor. And that trust, I think, overcomes a lot of deficiencies in what they're willing to change, or how they're willing to change with the times. So for existing client relationships who have been there for 10 years and are probably going to be there for another 10 years, but for new client relationships, that's a totally different equation. When you're thinking about, you know, all else equal, I'm going to pick a new financial advisor, well, you're probably going to want to pick one who has the most tools available to them, who's going to be able to do the best job for you. And the fact is, you are going to do a better job if you're empowered by AI tools than if you are not. And we see this in you know, industry statistics as well. For younger affluent investors, 4 out of 5 say they want their advisor to use AI tools, and a third of them will fire a non-adopter. So it's going to be different for, I think, the next generation of wealth, but for existing advisors, they're probably more safe than we all assume.
That's really interesting because I would not consider myself in that younger generation, but I absolutely would fire my advisor if they weren't leveraging the technology because I want the best data analytics. Otherwise, how do I know you're doing the best for my assets? I mean, it's sort of a no-brainer. So I think that's a really insightful. We do have to take a brief break, but folks, if you're watching this and you're in any industry, AI is best used for helping you to analyze your data, to get those metrics, and to make those informed decisions faster, better, faster, so you can better serve your client. But the one thing that Taylor and I agree on is you never outsource trust. You own your relationship and don't allow technology to overcome that. So what I'm hearing is AI isn't replacing financial advisors, but advisors who use AI are going to be the ones who are going to find more new clientele. As we move forward. Up next, how to productize intelligence and turn operational leverage into enterprise value. We will be right back. Welcome back to Power CEOs. Want more of what you're watching? Stay connected to this show and every Now Media TV favorite, live or on demand, anytime, anywhere. Download the Now Media TV app on iOS or Roku and unlock nonstop bilingual programming in English and Spanish. On the move? Prefer a podcast? Me too. Check us out at www.nowmedia.tv. From business and news to lifestyle and more, Now Media is streaming around the clock, ready when you are. But now, let's dive right back into our conversation because AI is the conversation everyone is having. We all know it. Automation saves time. But productized intelligence builds valuation. There is a very big difference. Many founders are using AI internally, few are building it into the product itself. I'm here with Taylor Matthews of Farther. We're going to talk about this distinction and why it matters for growth and exit. So, Taylor, what's the difference between using AI operationally and embedding it into your client product offerings?
Well, I think a lot of us use AI tools as both in our personal lives and in our business lives as as a enhancer. And I think it's great. You should absolutely be doing that, and we get a lot of leverage out of it. It's a little different when you're building it directly into a product because it's there. It takes a little bit more work, and you have to be really thoughtful about how you want that to appear to a client or a user. The way that I think about it is I take like AI note takers as an example. Like, they're great. Everybody likes AI note takers. They improve the transcription process and, you know, they make your lives a little bit easier. But if they're not connected to your core systems, if maybe they're even if they're logged into the CR or logged to the CRM, they're not like actually impacting your delivery, then you're probably missing value there. So, and to really at maximize the amount of value that you're going to get out of things like that, it needs to all be dropped into a common data lake. That's where you can provide the AI context that comes from lots of different places, the note taker, and maybe for us, like a portfolio management system. That allows advisors to be a little bit more proactive and to combine different data streams to you know, generate new insights to a client. And that's the difference between embedding it and using it.
I thought that was a really great explanation. Thank you for that. But what I'm going to ask you next is more in alignment with something that's really in your core expertise. And you know, we have a lot of founders who are now exiting. There's a lot of businesses that people are looking to retire, they're looking to exit. And so they're eyeing the valuation. And I'm an investor as well. And one of the things that I'm looking at is like, what is the IP? What is the technology? Because if we have IP that makes sense, it increases the valuation and it increases how much I'm going to pay per company. So talk to me about how does productized AI increase firm valuation with your wealth management and all your expertise? Like, What does that look like in for anybody in any industry who's watching?
Yeah, I think there's a short-term and a long-term answer to this. So in the short term, if you're thinking about, you know, maximizing the value of your business, you know, say for a sale or something, I think it's probably to your benefit to shout AI from the rooftops as much as possible and to, you know, make sure that you have exhausted ways to, you know, quickly integrate it into your product. I was once told by a venture capital investor here in the Valley that if I wanted to add $100 million to my valuation the next round, I should just say AI more. So that's a real thing. Long term, I think, you know, what creates real value is delivering a lot of value to your clients. And if you're thinking about like how can you maximize the long term of your business, then I think it's going to show up in growth, in revenue, in earnings when you are turning your product itself into something that's more valuable for your users. So that's going to be the ultimate source of like long run valuation success.
And now let me ask you a little bit more specifically in the financial industry, because there's a lot of people scrambling to add technology and whatnot to their products in your industry now all of a sudden. And so when you think about how sticky the industry already is in the wealth advisory side of things, does this become about who has the best technology or who gets there first or who's always innovating? How do you make sure that your tech aspect is just as sticky as the relational aspect?
Well, I think with the pace of innovation that's happening right now, I think the target should be it'd be as close to the front edge, the leading edge of that innovation as you possibly can. And that's certainly how we approach things. You know, understand where value is coming from and do your best to incorporate that into your products. Take advantage of every tool that's available to you and, you know, maximize everything from your marketing to your sales force to your, you know, the core product that you're delivering to your clients. I think the other things to like make it as sticky as possible, what that comes down to is like, is it a great product that people really like and are seeing value in? If you're continuing to ask yourself, am I delivering as much value as my competitors? Is there anything that I can learn from them? Is there anything more that I can do? I think you're probably on the right path there.
That's fantastic. So let's go back to the investor conversation. Because I know you play in both worlds. So what does investors' appetite look like for AI-forward financial firms, since that is your industry?
Well, I think that's honestly something that they're trying to figure out right now, is what is the impact of AI in the financial services space broadly? What does a truly AI-native firm built starting today look like, and how does it differ? Where are the sources of enduring value that are going to be created? I think there are a lot of open questions still. You know, for my own perspective, I have my answer, and you know, it's a firm that looks an awful lot like Farther. But I think the truth of the matter is that there's still so many open questions, and there's a lot of uncertainty around just, you know, what is a relationship with an AI going to look like? Is that going to impact the financial services, the advisory space, the wealth management space, or is it going to be another, you know, robo-advisor situation where there's a lot of promise, but maybe you don't want to eliminate the actual people and that trust element?
You know, I think that's very wise advice, folks. So, you know, the reality is technology is moving so fast that even as investors who are very tech-informed and tech-forward, we always have questions because the tech's happening faster than anything we can even dream of keeping up with from a compliance and a regulatory standpoint. So I'm going to ask that next question because I tend to work a lot, Taylor, with professional services, medical, legal, financial, people who are highly regulated. And one of the biggest questions that I'm getting from my audience is, how is AI changing compliance, regulatory posture? How do I keep myself safe when I'm using or developing, whether it's productized or operational, to ensure that I'm in compliance and will continue to be as that evolves, really, with as regulation evolves?
Yeah, I can speak to my industry, and where we see where what we see happening is that AI has been pretty amazing from a client's compliance perspective. There's only but so much you can do from a supervisory perspective as a human manually reviewing data. And when you create as much data as a firm like ours, as you know, you have advisors building their own marketing materials, websites that need to be logged and reviewed, trade blotters that need to be reviewed on a regular basis. You know, it's great at taking in a lot of information and flagging areas of concern really quickly. Well, it's AI. So we see some real advantages there. I think it allows us to not only be way more efficient with our time, but also surface up challenges, issues a lot sooner than we otherwise would, and take action against them.
Yeah, I see that with medical as well. It's really easy to spot any maybe error that's been typed in or whatnot and say, hey, did you really mean to say 10 grams? Because, the research says it's 0.1 or whatever that may be, right? That's a ridiculous example, but you'd be surprised, catching errors of omission. It's a huge opportunity to leverage the technology. So let me ask you next, what's the biggest misconception founders have about AI and AI strategy with their companies?
Well, I think from an AI strategy perspective, I think the biggest misconception is like that it's divorced from firm strategy, like strategy as a whole. I don't think founders should separate an AI strategy from what you're doing as a whole company. It's all interwoven together. So if from my perspective, if you're skating to where the puck is going and you're not considering what the impact of AI is going to be across every aspect of your business in 3 to 5 years, then you're probably doing yourself a disservice.
I agree with you. And a lot of times I get pulled in a lot. And the question is always, how should we, like, what should we go after? And it's kind of a shiny object syndrome instead of a, hey, this is who we are as a company. These are our key business initiatives, and this is where we're going, and where can technology be leveraged, implemented, integrated, or productized to meet those initiatives and goals? So you're right, it's aligning 100% with what your business is, the purpose of your business all the way through where you're growing and going. So thank you for that. We do have to take a brief break, but folks, think about this. If you're building a company, ask yourself the question, does AI reduce costs or increase revenue? Does it add value, real value, sticky value? Because if it's only reducing costs, you're optimizing, but you may lose some of the trust along the way. Cost savings improve margins, but intelligent products can create multiples. Let's talk about the founder journey, because scaling technology is one thing, but scaling yourself is another after these important messages. Build a business, few build an asset, and even fewer prepare themselves for that transition. Welcome back to Power CEOs. I'm Jen Godin, and I'm here with Taylor Matthews of Farther.com. Taylor, you have scaled in a regulated industry, built through complexity, and navigated growth pressure. Let's talk about what founders miss as they move towards that investor mindset. Like, talk to me a little about your journey. When does a founder need to start thinking more like an investor?
I think the answer to that is from the very beginning, right? Like, one of the things that you're doing as a founder is selling the dream, not only to other employees and co-founders that might join you, and of course winning your first clients and everything. But if you are going to go out and raise capital, then you're raising from investors who are going to think in that mindset, and you probably ought to understand where they're coming from, what their motives are, and what they would love to see in a business like yours. So I think the answer is, like, you always have to be thinking from an investor's mindset if you're going to build a business that lasts.
You know, I think about it, one of the biggest things that is a pet peeve for me is people don't think about succession or exit planning at all until they're ready to exit. And at that point in time, it's kind of late. And I believe that you should be thinking about the exit before you acquire a business or before you start a business, because what are we building towards is something that I really believe is essential. But talk to me now about like what mindset shift is required to move from operator to capital allocator, because this is a place as an investor and also as an advisor that I see a lot of founders and executives kind of fumble the ball. So what mindset shift has to happen, you know, in order to do this successfully?
No, I think as a founder, you're kind of asked to be that capital allocator from the very beginning. Right? Because you have scarce resources. There's only but so much time in the day, if nothing else, even if you have no capital at all, you need to know what to focus on. Should you, you know, spend that next hour, even if you're solo, on sales or product development? Should you handle an existing client request, or should you go out and find a new client? Like, what's more valuable? And that that changes over time as it's no longer you. You have teams of people doing each function. And you have to think about how do you allocate resources to each one of those to make sure that you're delivering the experience that you want to deliver while also doing all of the things that are necessary to run your business, everything from HR and finance to marketing and sales. So I think it just changes over time, especially in the later, once you have a few dozens of people at least, where you're making more explicit decisions around where should you put that next dollar to maximize the value of your company, and then drop right back down into an operations role if need be. The bigger your company is, the more time you spend on those questions, because the more projects that you could potentially run concurrently, and then I think saying no and figuring out what you're not going to spend time or resources on is just as valuable as what you will.
Yeah, I would agree with you. And so for those who have gotten to that point where now maybe they have the revenue coming in, they're large enough, they have teams in place that they're looking at a couple of different projects. And let's keep it to AI for now, just because it's an easy topic to discuss, because it's really relevant and these are the questions being asked. But how do you pick and choose which ones, which projects to prioritize if you've never done so before? And maybe you've got three projects that could be a go. They all align in different ways. How do you sort through the things that match with your initiatives and prioritize what happens first?
You know, I came from a management consulting background, at least in part. And what any management consultant will tell you is there's always room for a 2x2. So plotting out the impact, so the value that you expect on one axis, and the amount of effort required to realize that value on a different axis, will give you a nice little plot of the most valuable projects for the least amount of effort. And I think that's probably an exercise you want to run on a fairly regular basis. It helps you take something that seems very airy or hard to articulate and turns it into more of an analytic question. And that's much more tractable and can help you decide, especially when there's a lot of uncertainty.
It also helps you to set your metrics and to track your progress as you go. Man, this is awesome. You're preaching from my pulpit right now. I'm loving it. Folks, you know, you've heard about this. It's all about like, what is that impact versus effort to make that critical decision process. So let me ask you more in your arena, how does AI change how founders are now evaluating their investments internally in their own businesses? Have you come across that? Have you seen any change in behavior of founders leveraging the technology as they look towards the next investment? Maybe they're going to do an acquisition. Maybe they're going to diversify, personally or what have you.
Well, a really cool thing about AI is that you end up with a management consultant in your pocket. So, you can ask it all these hard questions and, it'll at least spit out something to you and often like something quite, quite well thought through. But I would say the other side of things is with AI, you can do a lot more. We see this especially on the software manufacturing side of our business, and I think, you see this kind of across the board, is when you're no longer making decisions about, which, three projects do I want to pursue? Maybe it's what 10 you want to pursue. And that, that does change the equation. It means that you could probably get to a more robust product quickly. It means you can probably do a little bit more with a little bit less capital. It might influence how you're even building all of your back office side, your operational side, to take advantage of technology as opposed to additional people that you thought you would have hired otherwise. But it changes, I think, the pace and the amount that you can do in a given time more than anything.
So I know you're well versed in exits, your own journey, and everything that you've done up to now. People are now, I believe, I know I'm gonna get the questions. Like, what mistakes did you make or have you made that you now are wiser that you could share with people who may be thinking about exit or thinking about adding the value of a productized AI or whatever it is that they're thinking, whatever project they're thinking of doing. What was your big mistake, and what did you learn that you would say, listen, folks, this is what you want to think about first?
Well,
I'm really interested.
as far as exits go, I think my answer is I don't know. I'm not exited, and I think we're a ways away. But what I would say is, I think if you're focused on building enduring value, then you're probably on the more right path. I remember one of the my first job out of college. I was working in an investment bank, and the managing director, his name was on the door, would often say, you should run a business like you're going to run it forever, or else you will. And I think that that's probably the best advice that I could give there is, think about, real value that you're creating rather than, chasing the shiny object. And I think you'll probably end up in a better place overall.
Yeah, and you help with the transition and on the wealth advisory side of things. What is it that founders don't think about when they go through an exit? We look at this and a lot of times I hear, oh, it's a big pot of money at the end of that rainbow. It's a lot of work to get there, and a lot of burnout happens because of due diligence or whatever. But like, what is it that you would love to share? Based on your experience working with clients, and that they can plan for or think about that they don't tend to think about.
So a couple things. So first off, start thinking if you're going to exit, plan for a longer period of time than you otherwise would think about. Is that not only gives you a chance to, get your own, wealth in order. There's lots of things that you can do when planning for a potential liquidity event down the line that you want to start ideally, 1 or 2 years out, as opposed to, getting down to crunch time and realizing that, like, oh, maybe this isn't the optimal structure for me and my family. Then there's also, how do you maximize the value of what you've created? So thinking through, who are potential buyers, and building relationships with them. Sometimes that takes quite a lot of time. I was speaking with a founder who had sold a large tech company to another larger tech company, and he related it took 2 solid years of developing a relationship with the corp dev team before it was finally time for him to say, "Oh, okay, we're ready now." And because they had that background and gotten to know each other over time and realized that they were a cultural fit, it was, an easy transaction and actually took a good deal less time than you otherwise would think. But you can be dragged along in processes, especially with corp dev departments. And I've certainly been counseled myself not to waste time with them unless you're really serious about it and are not going to distract your company otherwise.
Absolutely. And sage advice, folks. I'm just going to reiterate that because I think it's really important. If you're thinking about exiting, plan for a longer period of time. If you wake up today and say, I'm ready to sell my business, you're not going to get the best bang for your buck if you're on a fire sale or trying to hurry the situation. 1 to 2 years out at least. I like 3 to make sure that you have your financials clear, how to maximize your value, like who are your buyers, understand and that it's going to take time to build the relationships so you get the most out of the asset that you have poured your heart and soul into. And so it does take time. Sometimes, I mean, I've even had an experience where it took me 3 years to build the relationship to have the exit that I wanted. So, you know, it really is important that you don't leave that to chance and that you start thinking about it early and building those relationships, because relationships really and truly are how we accelerate what it is that we're doing in our business. We do have to take a brief break, but we're going to transition and talk about some of the hard stuff, because scaling is definitely comes with challenges. It comes with a lot of different things, from resilience and resistance to everything in between. And we're going to dive deep with Taylor after these messages. Welcome back to Power CEOs. Loving what you're watching? Don't miss a moment of this show or any of your favorites, streaming live and on demand wherever and whenever you want. Grab the free Now Media TV app in Roku or iOS for instant access to our bilingual lineup. Prefer podcasts? Me too. Listen anywhere you are at www.nowmediatv. From business to lifestyle to culture and more, Now Media is here 24/7. Let's dive right back into our topic today. We have had such an amazing conversation. We're talking about innovation, AI, what is technology doing in the financial sector? We've just finished talking a little bit about exits and what are the things that, you know, we want to look for. But now let's think about innovation a little bit deeper. Taylor, building in finance means, you know, compliance, skepticism, legacy systems, which we talked about earlier, and trust barriers. Take us inside the real challenges, because as others, I get a lot of questions about what is this really going to look like? Like, where are the pitfalls? What am I not seeing? So talk to me about the moment where you thought, this isn't going to work, or this might not work.
Well, sure. I think we opened our doors to investors that we did not know April 1st of 2020. So that was pretty incredible timing. We had this whole marketing plan that we were going to execute on. We had a path to 1,000 clients, and in a business that is very traditionally face-to-face, well, that wasn't an option anymore. So that was pretty scary. Like, before we even got going, we had to do a round of layoffs to extend runway, to make sure that we were we gave ourselves the best shot at getting this off the ground. And that meant that, you know, we had teammates, you know, myself included, doing things that we weren't sure that we were going to do before. All of my first clients, my first 50 clients or so, were cold LinkedIn outreach. So it was a little bit of a different strategy than what we had initially anticipated, but we adapted and we figured it out. And I think there was definitely a moment of we've sunk a year and a half more into building this, and to have this happen right now was terrifying. But, you know, I think we all together just decided that we couldn't control that, but what we could control was our actions as an output of the situation. We put one foot in front of the other and executed to the best that we could.
You know, and it's interesting that you say that. A lot of companies face the similar challenges, right, during that time. And I want to highlight what Taylor just said for everyone in the audience. We can't always control everything. We are in a climate right now where we can't control everything. Technology is going faster than what we can usually keep up with. There's geopolitical strain. What happens if the market crashes? There's all of these things that are external to ourselves, and they're external to our locus of control. But it was the execution of the things within his control that really kept them moving forward. So we can control how we respond and how we execute in our businesses. I thought that was very, very profound. Thank you. So talk to me now about what resistance are you facing from more traditional players in the market? Because you're coming in, you're innovating. You are, I would describe you as a disruptor in your industry? Like, what resistance do you find yourself facing, and how are you overcoming that?
Well, I think perhaps somewhat, maybe not uniquely, but the wealth market is a big space, right? That means that there's room for lots of winners. I think there's somewhere around 34,000 firms that serve clients in some capacity or another. That creates a room to innovate and to try different things and to, you know, but it makes it very hard to stand out. What I've been really encouraged by is that that many leaders of companies in the space that we work in and compete directly against us are actually like quite open to sharing time and thoughts, and it's more collaborative than you might think, because there's a lot of motivation around the end goal that we all share of serving clients. So that's not universally true, though. There are definitely some who have sued us for attracting their former employees and don't like the fact that their advisors see a better solution and want to go somewhere else to better serve their clients and grow their business. And that's I think that's the negative side of the industry, where there's a lot of resistance and the desire to create a chilling effect to keep employees where they are. And lock them in rather than end up serving clients better. And so that's something that we face every day. And we try and handle that to the best that we can with continuing to build the best product.
Yeah, absolutely. And for those that are watching, you're successful when you start getting lawsuits from your competition. Like it literally is. It's not if it's going to happen, it's when. And that's just a reality that we face in the world. And it's up to us to be the better people and to keep marching on so that we can continue to add value and have that impact. So Taylor, what was the operational mistake that taught you the most in this journey?
I'd be lying if I didn't say we made mistakes all the time. I'll call out one that I think was, it comes directly from success, which is sometimes you outgrow the processes that had been working at a certain level of scale and have to retool and rethink things at the next level of scale. For us, we had gotten behind on our service side at one point, and we could tell. Like, we could see experiences starting to deteriorate, wait times were increasing. We got we host regular feedback sessions with clients, advisors, and team members. So, we're hearing about these challenges anecdotally as well. And I think by the time it gets to that point, unfortunately, it's a bit too late. It is a challenge. So we, of course, scrambled. We aim to significantly overcorrect on this challenge so that we could then give ourselves some space to, we ended up doubling our service team, installing a layer of management that wasn't there before. But that takes time. It takes time to onboard, to find folks, to ramp them, to educate them on our culture and our processes. It was probably a full 6 months to fully address it. We ended in a much stronger place. And I think the the only advice I would give is try and set up as many early warning systems for things like that as you can. You're going to miss them, but and I'm sure we will make future mistakes in the same vein. But we hopefully can try and learn from that episode and anticipate when growth is going to really affect us more.
Absolutely, and I want to highlight something that you said, because I think this is really important. Feedback loops are everything. It really is essential that you have feedback loops built in. Not just for your internal teams, but also for your clients, because that's how you get a pulse on what's working and what's not. Thank you for sharing that. And you're right, I'm going to ask the next question and you might laugh, but so many people are afraid of failing and they stunt their growth because they're afraid they're going to make mistakes at the next level. What separates the founders such as yourself who break through from those challenges and actually get to the next level without burning out?
One of the hardest things about the job is how many times you get rejected. from the outside, it certainly looks like, we're an organization that has seen exponential growth without major deviances from that. Nonetheless, I get told, not good enough all the time from potential investors and others. And that's just it's part of the job. It's just like sales. Yeah, you're going to get people to say no to you. And the more that you get comfortable with like experiencing that type of feedback, and being able to, learn from it, experiment, iterate, I think that that's what separates businesses that ultimately end up creating a lot of value from those that don't. So it's there are other things. Timing plays a role, luck even plays a role, but the things that you can control are your effort and your learning. And you learn through experimentation. You put the learnings, put the effort into iteration over and over again, and you get closer and closer to that platonic ideal of whatever company that you're trying to build, your ideal business. It's a never-ending process, but I do think that the process itself helps you to create the value that you want to bring to the world.
It's fantastic. So folks, if you're building in a complex industry or even a simple one, don't just build a product, build patience, build resilience, build your compliance muscle, build trust. Future of business belongs to founders who are combining learning and execution, action, effort, intelligence, discipline, leverage. This is the time for you to really double down on that. It's double downing on yourself. And Taylor just gave us a masterclass on that. Thank you so much for pulling back the curtain on the future of finance and AI and also sharing a little bit about your learnings. How can people reach out to learn more, Taylor?
Well, you can find us at farther.com, or if you want to talk to me, I'm pretty easy to get to too. I'm Taylor@farther.com. Happy to chat.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. If you guys want to scale intelligently, you want to protect or build your value and prepare for that next chapter, this is the time to lean in. I think it's been a great conversation. Rewatch the show, reach out to Taylor@farther.com. Connect with me on LinkedIn. Let me know your feedback. Join the Power CEOs Facebook group. Let me know what you're looking for, because honestly, the truth behind the business is this: technology is accelerating, but your leadership, your learning, your execution is what determines your success. We unfortunately have come to an end of this show, but the good news is we'll be here same time, same station next week. So until then, win today, win this week, and we'll see you next time.